slowing down of the signal near the perimeter of the magnifying glass. This Koch antenna does the same thing. By way of a high density of washers acting as capacitors near the center of this big circle of foam, you get a more slow wave function in the center than you do at the perimeter. That really is a magnifying glass. A Yagi does that. A Yagi takes very little material and does a tremendous amount of focusing. Your Yagi made out of dipole-like structures, where each one of those dipoles is, what, 36 inches long approximately, roughly 3 feet long, a 7 or 8 element Yagi, let me drop, is made out of elements that are roughly 3 feet long, but now you actually set up the Yagi correctly and you measure its real gain, decibels, and you go back to the formula for converting gain into effective capture area. You'll find out this Yagi has a 10 or a 12 foot effective diameter of effective capture area. It's made out of elements that are only 3 feet long, and yet it is capturing energy from a 10 foot diameter of space. Man, that's magic. You can see how Mr. Yagi's antenna, invented in roughly 1928. Here we are 90 years or so later, an extremely popular antenna. It gives you a lot of bang for the dollar. Very little wind load, very little mass, very few dollars for the raw materials, and that 7 or 8 element 2 meter Yagi I just described is gathering energy from a 10 foot diameter of space, because a real parabolic dish antenna only operates at 60% or so efficiency. You'd have to make a 12 or a 13 foot diameter parabolic dish to have the exact same gain as that 2 meter Yagi I just described. Obviously, one has 100 times more wind load and weight compared to the other, and they both have the same gain. The bottom line is, let me drop. Parabolic dish antennas are very appropriate for frequencies like 1,000 megs and above. At 2 meters at 140 megs, do not use a parabolic dish. Use a Yagi. You get a hell of a lot more for your money. So, this is some of the phenomena called slow wave structure. A hell of a lot of the high-performance antennas really have buried in them somewhere a slow-wave structure that's doing all the work. KC2WGB, there's going to be a lot more questions on various versions of this, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB, great description. And as far as I know, you're the only guy that improved the Yagi in a way they said couldn't be done without computer modeling, which is good. And also, you have explained why, if you remember years ago in the days of on-air television, when you lost one of the elements off of the reflector, it didn't seem to bother the reception at all. But yet, if you lost anything off of the directives, the actives, yeah, that was a problem. Great description. All right, I think it's time to go over to Paul. Very good, Dick. KC2WGB, back to you.
I'm going to leave with a real quick question, Dick.
Yeah. N2 moonbounce, I think it is. Hey, Barry, you've used a lot of Yagis in your days. Go ahead with your question.
Okay, yeah, I'm just curious. The front-to-back ratio, why is that different in gain? I mean, you're saying you're not transmitting in the other direction, so you must be putting it in the direction that you're not transmitting. It's got to go somewhere. So why is front-to-back ratio different in gain?
Yeah, that's an extremely good question, Barry. The majority of what you and I call gain, beam width, directivity, is really main lobe beam width. If the main lobe out of my antenna, if I got a really good 19 element Yagi, and the main lobe is roughly 26 degrees wide, azimuth, and maybe 28 degrees wide in elevation, if you could see the three-dimensional antenna pattern, it's a great big cucumber in space as a three-dimensional antenna pattern. And the beam width horizontally and vertically is where the majority of the gain and directivity is coming from. The actual amount of energy being reflected off the back of the antenna is only a couple of percent. If you could gather every bit of the energy off the back lobe of the antenna and put it forward, it's going to make a difference of a couple of tenths of a dB of gain. That's when you look at it from a gain point of view. Now let's look at it from a back lobe point of view. If my back lobe is, let me pick a number, 5% of the energy. 5% of the energy is 1/20th. 1/20th is 13 dB. So in my example, if 5% of the energy is coming off the back of the antenna, and that lobe would be roughly 13 dB lower than the front lobe, so to speak. That would be a 13 dB front-to-back ratio. If I could gather every bit of that back lobe of energy and send it forward, I gain an extra 5%, a couple of tenths of a dB. If I make the back lobe, instead of being 5% of the energy, I make it 0.05% of the energy. So that now the back lobe is, instead of 13 dB down, it's 33 dB down. I've only taken that 5% of the energy that used to be in the back lobe and made it 0% almost. I'm going to gain a couple tenths of a dB forward. But the back lobe, I'm comparing signal of back lobe compared to a rough
repeater. Time out.
Let's see if we've got the, okay, we still got the eastern input. If I'm only taking a few percent of that back lobe, and if I've got the right kind of a reflector structure that I null out every bit of it, I can now take a 13 dB down back lobe and make it 33 dB down or 40 dB down. If I'm smart enough, I can make it more than that. The total amount of energy there is very little in percentage of what's in the forward lobe. But the way you and I measure back lobe, comparing it to the forward lobe, that tiny bit of percentage of decrease because of the way decibels behave, if I've got a signal that's a tenth of the voltage and I make it 1/100th of the voltage, I've now made that signal in decibels 20 dB weaker. You can see that very little change in total energy out the back can make a huge difference in what you and I measure as the front-to-back ratio. There ain't much energy back there, but you and I, in some cases, would like that back lobe to be 40 dB down because it's some honking big signal of a guy in Connecticut when you aim down toward to the southwest, and this guy in Connecticut is bombing the daylights out of you, and if you've got a real good front-to-back ratio, he ain't bombing you anymore. So from an energy point of view, you're not consuming, we're not exceeding physics here, Barry. Just this crazy way you and I measure dBs that makes that back lobe front-to-back ratio in some cases very important. I wonder if that makes a little more sense. N2 Moonbound, KQLIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, it does make sense. Of course, front-to-back ratio comes into play when you're trying to eliminate static or signals, you know, anything off the back. And that means that your noise ratio is going to be a hell of a lot better, and a lot of the times you can't hear a signal because there's static there. So front-to-back ratio is a very important thing, in my opinion. K2RW and 2MB.
You live in a very metropolitan area of New York City, one of the five boroughs of New York City, where there's a hell of a lot of strong signals. So yes, the QR Mary you could be getting, and in some cases QR Nancy, from fluorescent lighting or whatever. If you can make that back lobe a lot weaker, you've got a huge advantage. When you're aimed to the southwest across the Atlantic Ocean and you're listening to a signal coming from Philadelphia or Maryland or Virginia, the back lobe, the back hemisphere of your antenna, you would like it to have a lot of rejection because that back lobe is aimed toward other portions of Brooklyn and Queens nearby, which is making a lot of noise. When you're doing moonbounce and the antenna is aimed up in the air, that back hemisphere of the antenna is looking at hot Earth. Hot Earth is at 290 degrees Kelvin. You've got a low noise preamplifier that electronically has a 20 degrees Kelvin, if you know what I mean. You've really got a cryogenic antenna when it's aimed at cold sky that's got a little piece of a moon in the middle of the antenna. Let me drop. So the back hemisphere of your antenna, it's apparent front-to-back ratio where you're looking at the whole back hemisphere, which is looking at the hot Earth of Far Rockaway, which is radiating a lot of radio noise compared to your low noise preamplifier. You'd like to have a real good front-to-back ratio, which lowers your antenna temperature, and you'd like the antenna to not be the hottest thing compared to your preamplifier. You'd like it to be cold. You'd like to have a cold antenna radio astronomy-wise when you're doing moonbound, so you get the full performance out of that low noise preamplifier that you put a lot of effort into building it at 20 degrees Kelvin. A cryogenically cooled gas fed, if you could do it, if you know what I mean. So back hemisphere, if you could gather all the energy of the back hemisphere and aim it forward. It's only going to make a few tenths of a dB of difference in the gain of the antenna, because that director string has done all the work of capturing that energy of that cucumber in space. But if you can knock down that back lobe by another 10 dB, the back hemisphere, you can pick up a huge improvement in antenna gain to temperature ratio. When it comes to radio astronomy antennas and moonbound antennas, the number that gives you, let me drop it. The number that gives you the performance of that antenna, the report card, is called gain to temperature ratio. You literally measure the temperature of the antenna, radio noise wise, while the antenna is aimed at cold sky, up in the air. You compare that to the forward gain of the antenna. That ratio tells you how good that antenna is for radio astronomy or moonbounce, gain to temperature ratio. There's a number of ground stations, these stations that are set up to talk to satellites, where whether or not the vendor that builds the antenna for you, whether or not he gets the full payment of his contract, and whether or not he gets the extra bonus, in many cases the contract is written in such a way that whatever gain to temperature ratio you achieve determines whether or not you get the full bonus on that contract for that ground station antenna. Because that's where the rubber meets the road. If that antenna is looking at a lot of noise out of the back lobe, then that signal coming from that satellite is not going to sound as good to you. In the worst case, if you can't afford to buy a better antenna, let me drop. There were cases where the ground station operator spread a whole lot of metal screening on the ground behind the antenna, so that now he's reflecting cold sky into the back lobes of the antenna instead of the hot earth. You can stop the hot earth from radiating noise into the back lobe of your antenna if you're willing to lay down a whole bunch of screening. A number of ground stations
using another reflector could improve that front-to-back ratio.
Whether or not all that screening on the ground is a kind of reflector, and whether or not it's part of the antenna, even though it doesn't steer with the antenna. Now, we're into academics here. When you and I are setting up a reflector on a Yagi antenna, we can create a beautiful front-to-back ratio, but only in one spot. You can tune that reflector and maybe put two reflectors and maybe a trigonal reflector system, and the majority of what you do is that at exactly the 180-degree point on the antenna, the real back lobe, you can create a real good no. But for many cases, it's not just that one little no you care about. It's the whole back hemisphere you care about. In the extreme case, some people have put a Yagi aimed forward in front of a parabolic dish-like structure to try to lower the noise of the whole-on back lobe. In the case of a ground station, they lay a whole lot of metal screening down in the ground. So when it comes to the total noise coming into the antenna, don't just measure front-to-back ratio at one point in that back lobe. It's the whole darn back hemisphere you care about. Do you see that function there, Barry? And two moon bounce, K2RIW in the tech pad.
I sure do. So, I think I gathered from this, possibly with small antennas, you know, 15, 16 elements, something like that, having a couple of reflectors could help rather than just one or none.
You're absolutely right. Now you know how the trigonal reflector became popular in the United States. You might say to yourself, where the hell did the trigonal reflector come from? It turns out that after World War II, a couple of guys in some crazy country outside of the Soviet Union, looking through a fence with a camera, started taking pictures of the Yagi-like antennas that were used in Soviet radars, and they saw this trigonal reflector system and said, what the hell is that? And then somebody started experimenting with it on an antenna range and said, hey, look at that. It lowers quite a bit of the back hemisphere. So to my knowledge, the trigonal reflector system really was a Soviet invention, and somebody came up with a photograph of one of those through the fence, and somebody started asking the question, what is that? That's my belief as to where it may have come from, Barry. M2 Moonbound, KQLAW.
Okay, and comparing the Yagi to a parabolic dish, how does the front to back ratio pan out in a parabolic dish?
Yeah, there you've got a conflict of interest. When you and I choose a parabolic dish, it's usually because it's a great big thing that we bought, we don't want to build it, and it comes with a particular focal length to diameter ratio. 0.33 is the D.S. Kennedy dish, for instance. And if it was a modern day dish built by the Dick Turin technique, W2IMU, you'd make it a very flat dish, a 0.6 F over D. In either of those cases, there's an ideal feed horn beam width that properly feeds that dish. If this is the best of all worlds, you would like all the energy coming out of your feed horn to evenly illuminate the dish that gives you the maximum gain, and you would like none of the energy to spill out over the edge of the dish. Well, that's a very difficult thing to do. The bottom line of all this, let me drop it, that in most cases, when you choose the beam width of the horn that's feeding your parabolic dish, if you set it up so the beam width falls 10 dB down at the perimeter of the dish, including the distance, extra distance to the perimeter, as well as the angle to the perimeter. If the edge of the dish is illuminated 10 dB down, you get maximum forward gain. However, that 10 dB down means you've got a certain amount of energy flowing over the edge of the dish going into that back lobe, coming from your own, the back hemisphere, coming from your own feed horn. So if you want to set up the horn of the dish so you get the lowest noise temperature of the dish, you might adjust for a horn of a sharper beam width so that the edge of the dish is not illuminated 10 dB down, but 20 dB down. Now instead of 10% of the energy flowing over the edge of the dish, it's only 1% of the energy. That's what 20 dB down means. 20 dB down is 1%. 10 dB down is 10%. So you might choose a feed horn that's giving you an edge illumination that's 20 dB down. You get a quieter dish, but you'll sacrifice a little bit of the gain. Somewhere in between those two extremes of 10 dB down, maximum gain, 20 dB down, lowest noise temperature, maybe 13 dB down gives you the best gain to temperature ratio. But every dish has some back lobes because of the diffraction effect of energy spilling over the outer perimeter of the dish and flooding that back lobe. You see what's going on here, Barry? The Dick Turin, let me drop it. The Dick Turin W2IMU dual mode feed horn, which is something that I think he filed a patent on as a beautiful article in antennas and propagation way back in somewhere around 1976 or so is when he published those articles. And that's the same year that I was using it in front of my 12-foot parabolic dish to listen to the Apollo 16 astronauts. Anyhow, what I'm getting at is that dual-mode horn really is a poor man's equivalent of a phased array. It's a antenna pattern of the horn, which is a lot flatter out to the perimeter and then falls off more abruptly. It really is a three-element antenna, so to speak, or at least a two-element antenna. So the real performance of a good parabolic dish can be highly described and can be greatly generated by the amount of technology you put into that feed horn. If this is the best possible feed horn, it squirts all of your energy out to the dish, equal smearing of energy everywhere in the dish, and abruptly falls to zero at the edge of the dish. And on paper, you and I can design... On paper, you and I can design a horn like that. It would be a phased array cluster feed of a whole bunch of horns at the focal point. And to do a good job of that, there'd be about 36 horns there with just the right physical distribution and just the right phasing harness feeding them. And now you would get that antenna pattern. Oh, by the way, that cluster feed ideal horn would be about 10 or 15 wavelengths in diameter. If you're using a dish that's 100 wavelengths in diameter, it's going to work like a charm. If you're using a dish that's only 10 wavelengths in diameter, then your horn is going to give you complete blockage. You're wasting your time to make it into a parabolic dish. Just take that horn and aim it forward at the target, if you know what I mean. So with the finite size dishes that you and I can muster at our frequencies, Perry, We don't have the option of building that horn because it would be too big a blockage. However, that horn does exist. You get nearly 95% efficiency with beautiful illumination taper out of the parabolic surface that's called optical telescope. Mount Palomar does that. That eyepiece of the Mount Palomar really is the feed horn. It is 100 wavelengths in diameter. It's got that magic antenna pattern that feeds all the energy onto the parabolic surface with no spillover. Because that dish is 100,000 wavelengths in diameter, you have the option of doing that optically. Radio-wise, you and I don't have enough wavelengths where we can do that yet. As we go up high enough in frequency, we're going to start doing that, Barry. N2 Moonbounce, K2LAW in the TechNet.
Think what you're saying, in fact I know what you're saying, is that transmitting and receiving are really two different animals when it comes to antennas. It ain't the same thing. And possibly two different feeds to the same parabolic dish would make sense. One for receiving and one for transmitting. These are different animals and they have different problems. Back to you, sir. And I learned a lot. K2RW at 2MB. Mobile.
You hit it right, Barry. You and I have the option of building two separate horns. One horn is going to have 10 dB taper, gives you maximum gain when you're transmitting that signal toward the moon. Then when you want to receive the signal back, you flip over to the other horn, which has a 13 or 15 dB taper, so you get the best possible gain to temperature ratio, the quieter horn, on reception. Because on reception, antenna temperature counts more, a little more than gain. That's actually gain to temperature ratio, but you make that ratio desirable on reception, whereas on transmitting, it's only the gain you care about. So you flip one horn to the other, depending on whether you're transmitting or receiving. And there's probably ways that you and I could have one fancy horn that flips from one mode of operation for transmitting and another mode of operation for receiving, because it's two separate horns inside of each other, and depending on which one of the probes you feed, you've got one antenna pattern out of the horn or the other antenna pattern. So you and I have the technology, Barry, to build a composite horn that changes its antenna pattern depending on whether we're transmitting or receiving. Wouldn't that be a nice horn? That'd be the next step in the W2IMU horn. N2MB, K2RAW. Over to you, Barry.
Hey, Dick, I'm going to let you take it from here. That was really educational, and I suspected this all along. But when you put it in plain sight, and a lot of people don't think about it, transmitting and receiving is not the same animal on an antenna. It is not. Back to you, sir, and I'm going to keep listening in to MB Mobile.
Yeah, particularly on a ground station antenna, transmitting and receiving are quite different. When it comes to an antenna aimed at the horizon, if you had an antenna that suppresses all the back lobes, and you think you're going to make the antenna quieter, whereas the front lobe is still looking, half of the front lobe is still looking at hot Earth, you don't get as much gain, so much improvement, by taking the back hemisphere and suppressing it. In the case of the industrial environment or the metropolitan environment where you live, that back hemisphere represents a hell of a lot of transmitters on the Empire State Building and fluorescent lights in your neighborhood and so on. So suppressing that back lobe when the antenna is aimed down to the southwest, so to speak, gives you a lot of advantage. When the antenna is aimed through the Empire State Building to talk to that guy in Michigan, well, you're not going to get that benefit. So pays your money and takes your choice. So antenna patterns. Oh, there's a lot of art and science to designing antenna to have a particular pattern. Let me drop. There's a ridiculous number of people who lose a tremendous amount of sleep and do a hell of a lot of antenna computer modeling because they think that the forward lobe is a good thing, that they want to maximize it. They're right there. They think all the energy put into the side lobes are wasted energy. They're misunderstanding physics on that one. There's a very specific amplitude the side lobes have to have if you want to adjust the antenna for maximum gain. There's a lot of people who have spent tremendous amounts of energy trying to design an antenna that has no side lobes. There's a whole bunch of laws of physics saying you can't do that. And if you did do that, the antenna would have very low forward gain and efficiency. There's some very specific side lobes that have to be there. But when it comes to the back lobes, yes, that back hemisphere, there are ways of designing the antenna that makes the back hemisphere weaker and weaker, and there's huge benefits in doing that. There you're not exceeding any laws of physics. Theory, the highest gain antenna a few years ago on planet Earth, parabolic dish antenna, was Mount Palomar, 200-inch diameter parabolic mirror, operating at optical frequencies. Let me drop. That antenna, really an optical radio, it's an optical telescope, but you can call it an antenna. It's got something like 160 decibels of gain, and it's got a huge front-to-back ratio. However, that antenna, which has almost uniform illumination, the so-called feed horn, which really is the eyepiece is feeding energy if you were transmitting. When you're receiving it, by reciprocity, it's the same thing per se. That eyepiece is feeding energy across that parabolic 200-inch diameter surface uniformly and abruptly falls to zero out at the edge. That most ideal antenna pattern, where that surface is being used at like 95% efficiency, it has an antenna pattern which the optical people call airy disk. And the airy disk is such that it has predictable side lobes. That first side lobe is a ring 13 dB down. The second side lobe is a ring 17.5 dB down. The third side lobe is a ring 23 dB down. When you've got a parabolic dish antenna at an optical frequency running at near 100% efficiency, the laws of physics say those side lobes have to be there. You can't eliminate them. They do not represent wasted energy. So therefore, these guys that are trying to build Yagis by computer modeling that have no side lobes, they're wrong. And now, those side lobes of that airy disk is where the dish is giving you the maximum efficiency. Let me drop. Those magic numbers, 13 dB down, first side lobe, 17.5, second side lobe, 22 or 23 dB down, third side lobe. Those magic numbers are the exact numbers you want. You do something with the antenna pattern. So you make those side lobes weaker. The forward gain will be lower. Make those side lobes stronger than those magic numbers. The forward gain will be lower. You make those magic numbers the exact right numbers, you get maximum forward gain and maximum performance. That's very opposite of common sense. But once you understand the laws of diffraction, what's really going on is that Mother Nature doesn't like a discontinuity. You have this beautiful 200-inch diameter parabolic surface, and at the edge of that surface, the energy abruptly falls to zero. That's a huge discontinuity. Mother Nature doesn't like a discontinuity. You could say she responds by creating side lobes. They have to be there. You could taper the energy slowly as you go out toward the perimeter so that there's no spillover, and the side lobes will get weaker. But you'll sacrifice some forward gain in the process of doing that, because now the perimeter of the parabolic surface, where the maximum area exists, you're not fully illuminating it. You get lower gain. You can't have it both ways. You can't have zero side lobes and maximum gain. Very specific side lobe amplitudes that have to exist when you maximize the gain. Now, you take the guys who have carefully tuned Yagi antennas. Let me drop. You take a guy who has carefully tuned a Yagi antenna on a high-performance outdoor antenna range, and he's got maximum forward gain by the way he's adjusted all of the length and position of all of those directors. By ham radio tweaking with a real good ratiometry antenna range, you get a guy who carefully tunes a Yagi antenna. He's got maximum gain for that particular number of elements on that boom, and best impedance match on the driven element. You go and measure the antenna pattern. That first side lobe is 13.5 dB down. 13 dB down. The second side lobe is 17.5 dB down. Third lobe is side lobe 22.5 dB down. The Yagi antenna has the equivalent of the airy disk antenna pattern. We've been looking at that for years and didn't recognize it, staring us in the face. Ain't that crazy? I know we're off subject, but to me, this is, as you can tell, antennas are my favorite subject. And how do you get the highest performance? How do you get the highest performance out of antenna is also the fine detail. If somebody wants to ask a question on this, give me your call letters right now. KQRIW. Okay, yeah, back to you, John. I know we got left of center, but I think we got into a slightly interesting side lobe here. KC2WGB, KQRIW.
WGB, very interesting. Absolutely. Yeah, antennas are a lot of fun. That's about it from the mailbag, Dick. We'll go over to Paul, see what exciting news he has for us. Back to you, KC2WGB.
What are those spacey guys doing this week, Paul? NASA, European Space Agency, and the European Southern Observatory, and the Japanese Space Agency. Let's see that. And it's got to be, let's see, we've got space agencies in Japan, China, United Kingdom, Europe, Germany, Chile, United States, Canada. Oh boy, the space agencies all over the place. These spacey guys, what are they doing this week, Paul? WS2N, KQRIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, Roscosmos in Russia. In India, you got another one. Of course, Japan, you mentioned China. Even Brazil is trying to put together some kind of a reputable launch facility down there. But yeah, it's worldwide. Try to keep up with it. It's a lot of fun, but it comes out to be last year there was almost 90 launches, you know, for 2015 worldwide. There was actually a few more than that the previous year, but we're averaging, you know, it's coming close to 100 launches per year worldwide. I just wanted to mention that we always talk about Voyager. Voyager 2 actually went over to 110 AU from the sun, so clicked over. And Voyager 1 is ahead of that. Of course, there were 134 almost, getting close to that AU. So we always keep track. It's roughly about 3.5 AU per year. So let me drop this. Beginning of this year, anyway, you have some launches that are coming up. InSight, of course, was canceled. We talked about that a couple of weeks ago. InSight was going to be a Mars mission by NASA, and fortunately, the detector that France was building for us was not able to be fixed. That was the one with the vacuum sphere that was supposed to be hermetically sealed. Didn't work out. That'll probably go in 2018. But there's other missions coming up. We talk about worldwide. European Space Agency has a flight that's coming up in March to Mars. Actually, it'll be the only flight for 2016 from anywhere. It's two launches in one. They have the Trace spacecraft that's going to go into orbit around Mars, looking for signs of methane and other chemicals, but it's also going to have a lander. The lander is called the Schiaparelli, and it's going to be landing on Mars. And they only plan on leaving it alive for about 6 to 8 days at the most. It's going to run on batteries. What they want to do is confirm that they have the ability to land something on Mars. They've tried it in the past, and it hasn't worked out for them. Drop it. So this time around, they have an arrangement with Russia to launch these rockets. So this is going to go up in March on a proton rocket, two spacecraft at one, and then 2 years from now, they plan on launching another one called the XL Mars Rover. So the lander worked out good, and they don't feel they have confidence in doing this. And 2 years from now, they'll send their own rover, just like well, we have two operating now, third one going in 2020. Mars one operating, using all the satellites that are up there for repeaters. Let me drop it. Just wanted to go over real quick. Going into a new year of what went on in 2015. Like that's about 90 launches. We didn't cover all the launches here on the net. We try to pick out the ones that are interesting, ones that make it on TV, and the ones that are interesting to ham radio operations. There's quite a few of them. So we had the New Horizon, which went past Pluto. And that was probably the biggest story of the year as far as the news media was concerned. Then we had our interesting topics like the SAP mission that went into orbit, the big rotating antenna that unfortunately failed. That did fail this year. Went up at the end of 2014, in the beginning of the year. I always thought personally that this whole antenna contraption wasn't going to work, but it kept on spinning. There was no problem there, but they had a failure with the they have a high-powered amplifier that actually failed on that unit. So they're operating in a passive mode instead of the one that they wanted to do. Japan had the spacecraft called Akatsuki, I think is the name or way they pronounce it. That launched in 2010. And it missed going into orbit around Venus, wound up going around the sun. It took 5 years to get back near Venus, and they successfully put that into orbit at the end of the year. Drop it.
Repeater, timeout.
Okay. On that out. Well, it went into orbit around Venus successfully. That was by Japan. We had the launch of Scott Kelly and his counterpart from Russia launched into the International Space Station for their one-year mission. They're still in the process of doing that, and they'll be back next March. So that happened in 2015. You have the H-2B by Japan launched the H-2 cargo ship to the International Space Station aboard 10,000 pounds worth of stuff. You had the Vega rocket launch from Kourou, French Guiana, by European Space Agency, and they had was sort of like a space plane on it. They're testing the future of, similar to what we had for a space shuttle. They had a small version, and it was called the Intermediate Experimental Vehicle, IXV. And worked out good. They said that actually not on an orbital flight, but they launched from South America and wound up landing in the Pacific Ocean. But successful, and they plan on doing something about 4 years from now, an improvement on that system. Maybe next time bring it back to a landing field. With the CRS-7 and CRS-6, CRS-6 by SpaceX, which successfully brought cargo to the International Space Station. CRS-7 failed. That's the one that blew up in the summertime, and it took with it the ITER, the International ITER docking adapter that we're going to attach to the space station. But
repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
I really gotta operate duplex one of these days. They made up for it later. You had the Soyuz go up, Soyuz M27, and that was a progress mission that failed. Wound up going out of control, never made it to the space station that was a cargo vehicle that went out of control and came back into the atmosphere, burnt up. Russians fixed that. They had a successful launch or two after that. Atlas V, we had the X-37B. That's the military. The looks like a small space shuttle, probably one-fourth the size. And that's now on its fourth mission. It goes up, stays into orbit for almost a year, and then comes back, lands in Vandenberg Air Force Base. And then Blue Origin had a successful flight launched in Texas, got up to space suborbital. They brought that boost back and landed in a vertical position. But of course, Falcon 9 by SpaceX outdid that, sent 11 satellites into orbit and successfully. This happened just not too long ago. Of course, we reviewed this last week, and that booster came back to Cape Canaveral and landed vertically as well. And they're going to actually bring that over to Launch Pad 39A, which is now being controlled by SpaceX, and they're going to bolt it up to that launch facility, fire the engines. It's not going to go anywhere. They're going to lock it down, and they just want to prove that all mine will come back to life. I think they're going to keep that because, you know, it's a piece of history. But the next flights after that, like the you have a Jason 3 flight that's going up to NASA by SpaceX being launched out of Vandenberg Air Force Base. That one will probably be returned as well, and that might be the first one eventually in 2016 to be launched. There is SES that makes satellites that is willing to put their satellites on a booster that's been won before. So that's pretty much it, Dick. I know it's lengthy, but I just want to go over 2016. Back to you. This is WS2S.
Don't worry about being lengthy here, Paul. We get a lot of positive mail on the Space X, the Space the SpaceNet. This was Space Report number 182, I believe, and we get a lot of positive mail about it. There are people who intentionally tune the TechNet in order to hear the Space Report. To them, that's the most interesting part. People that I guess don't care as much about antennas, noise figure, and standing wave ratio, and power output, and whatever. It takes all kinds. So don't worry about it. What's your guess, Paul, if the United States, not the United States, if the world made a total of 90 launches in the year 2015, your guess the year 2016 will be close to that same number, above it or below it? And 2016, I think in a decade ago, we used to believe that the infrared telescope, why I keep forgetting, the James Webb telescope, way back when, was going to be launched in 2016. I'm willing to wait for them to get it right, because they're only going to get one shot at it. Let me drop it. I think the James Webb Space Telescope, infrared telescope, I think it's the biggest optical mirror we've ever put into space. We're putting it a million miles away from the Earth, behind the Earth, at Lagrange Point number 2, I think it is. And ambitious project. Huge mirror, super sensitive infrared telescope. Going to look through all that dust and see what's going on in the center of these galaxies. It has the ability to, in some cases, by way of its coronagraph, it's going to have the ability to directly see some of the planets coming around some of those stars. That's going to be an exciting mission, and I think that's, I guess it's the tail end of 2018 is when I think that gets launched. But if I had to make a guess, I'm going to guess that that's right now in the vicinity of $2 billion worth of hardware. Is that the, in the right ballpark, Paul? WS2N, KQLIW?
Oh, yeah, they're up to an $8 billion. It's going to be a total of an $8 billion investment by the time they're done. But, yeah, you mentioned launches. Actually, we're 87, if you want to go by the numbers. Last year, it was a few more than that. But we didn't have the most. Believe it or not, China's catching up. Russia had 26 flights from Russia. And we had 22. And China's catching up. They had 20 flights. They're in the running. ESA, that's the European Space Agency, they had 11. Most of their flights are Ariane 5 rockets, very big rockets. Then you had some, three or four from Japan, launched a kind of telescope, and then two flights to the International Space Station, with each flight about 10,000 pounds worth of supply. And you even had one from, there were two from India, and one from Iran, believe it or not, they sent one into orbit, forgot what that was about. As far as telescopes, I'm dropping. You're right, it's 2018 for James Webb, and I believe that's September. So I'm looking forward to eventually another flight after that, probably, 2023, maybe 2024. They have one called WFIRST. That's it's an Earth orbital telescope, and the diameter of it is roughly about the same as Hubble. So that should be interesting. Hubble's at what? I think 400 or 500 mile high orbit, around 400 mile high. The WFIRST, they plan on sending on a geosynchronous orbit system, just stay in one position. That should be pretty cool. And the Mira, they were going to start off with couple of foot Mira or some small number. Let me drop it. When they were WFIRST a long time ago, but then what happened is they realized, or found out, the time was right, that the NRA, I'm trying to think of that name of the group, not the defense people, it'll come to me. They're the ones listening to everybody. They had two telescopes left over they would put up spy telescopes. The Hubble. And NRO, by the way, National Reconnaissance Office. And they said to NASA, you want one of these telescopes? It's got a big 8-foot dish just like your Hubble. We don't need it anymore. We're not going to send it up. And they decided to incorporate that into the WFIRST scope. So it's going to be like another Hubble type deal.
Hey, excuse me, they bought them.
Looking at gravity lensing to actually focus and see planets, instead of just using the transit effect. The transit effect is great, what Kepler's found. Almost 5,000 candidates, probably over 1,000 planets confirmed using that method. But, with a transit, you have to have that planet going directly in front of the sun or in front of their star for us to notice, any kind of a dimming effect. And then it would have to be repeated maybe a month later, or a day later, or a year later, to see if it's really true. You could see the planet. You won't have to worry about, repeating it. You could actually say, hey, there's a planet. You don't have to worry about it. The countless planets that Kepler could have missed. You could have a planet that's not going directly in front of the star. You could have it, you know, on a 90-degree plane with us, and you can see it. You know, that number would be really skyrocket if they could actually see the planet. Back to you, Dick. This is WS2, Space Net Report 182, I think it is.
Yes, it is 182. And I think we got Joel signing in. And I think he's in the North Island of New Zealand. K2QBV might have a space question. Let's see if Joel does. K2QBV, I think by Echolink or IRLP. K2LAW in the TechNet. Go right ahead, Joel.
No, I just turned it on and heard you guys. I thought I'd try it. You guys continue. We'll catch you later. It's 5 o'clock in the afternoon. See you another day. Kilowatt 2, Queen, Bravo, Victor, Silk, Zulu, Lima.
As you maybe are the greatest DX we have ever signed into the TechNet, Joel, I think you're on the North Island of New Zealand. I think you're on vacation, but maybe you're there for business. And you are probably the greatest DX we've ever had. You know better than we do roughly how many miles between you right now and Queens, Long Island, where this repeater is located. So give us a few words on where you are, what you've been hearing. Is there a local repeater in New Zealand that picks up the TechNet? Or is it something you specifically dialed in? So give us a little bit of the local terrain where you are. What's the name of the town and so on, Joel. K2QBV, our greatest DX, K2RAW in the TechNet. You got it, Joel.
K2QBV, well, I'm near Palmerston North is north of Wellington. I'm not on 2 meters. I just picked it up now, and I did it last night. I just came off of 20 meters using my fed station, talking to Australia. I don't know what's on 2 meters here. We're on vacation. We're in Tahiti, operating from Tahiti with my ex-girl and myself for a little bit, playing radio. Spent 8 days there, flew to Auckland, and flew down to Palmerston North. It's on the North Island, just above Wellington. And then from Wellington, you can see the South Island. All right, I want to say, Richard, continue. I'm sorry, I didn't know what was on here this time of day. It's 5:30. I'm just waiting for a nice dinner. So we're back to New York around the 10th. I just moved to another location or in between, so I won't be on that on 2 meters or anything until I put my tower up. Although the concrete is in, it'll take a little time. Back to you, Dick. Let me not interrupt. I realize a bunch on here. Hope you got it all. This is Kilowatt 2, Queen, Bravo, Victor, so Zulu, Lima. We're 8,400 miles away. See ya.
8,400 miles away. That's down the road a piece. Now, because I'm not a computer maven, the one thing I don't know, you did tell us you're not coming in by 2 meters, you're not coming in by Echolink. So, what is the method by which you are linking to us right now, Joel? Is it over a cell phone into a Wi-Fi network, internet? I'm guessing you're getting, without a doubt, you're getting here by internet. But how did you get access to the internet? Are you speaking into a cell phone right now, or are you at a base station desktop computer? What is your method of really getting access to us right now, Joel? K2QBV, K2RAW in the TechNet.
Oh, I'm in the backyard on a swing. I came in through Echolink. I did program in a few things, although I didn't do too much other than Echolink. And that's it. Beautiful day here, nice and sunny, and it's going to be really nice tomorrow. It's our summer here, and you're not in it. That's what I'm using, and I'm catching you guys fine. Back to you with...
Now, Echolink implies you're going through a ham radio station, but maybe I'm wrong on that one. But you said you're not coming in on 2 meters. You're talking to Echolink by way of a cell phone into a particular local telephone number or a particular website. There's missing ingredients here because I'm not a computer maven. You're talking into a cell phone is my guess. The cell phone is connected to what? What's the first step in your Echolink connection to us, Joel? UAW in the TechNet?
No, I just put in a few days ago the EchoLink directly, and that I'm going through Wi-Fi system for one of the ways of going in. So I'm sitting on a little iPhone 6 in the backyard on a swing waiting for dinner. That's all. Don't make it more complicated because you're a Tesla guy. It's pretty simple. Hit EchoLink, sit back and talk. That's it.
Very fine, Joel, and I got one last question. You're one of the best world travelers in ham radio that I know of. The cell phone is in your hand right now. When you get the right kind of personality card and what have you, your particular cell phone, can you operate it from half or three quarters of all the countries in the world? What's your guess as to how applicable your particular cell phone is right now to in various, how many countries in the world do you believe you would have contact with that cell phone that's in your hands right now? Over to you for a final, Joel. K2QBV, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Probably about 90% of it. I arranged before I left New York to come to Tahiti to program in a SIM card and also one other thing. They have a new device out now, so I could get into most anything. It's $25 a month to hit anything on the internet or hit anything with a regular phone call. It's pretty new now, so I mean I do travel a lot, but not as much as I used to. But that's it. Nothing other than that, and it's pretty simple. Back to you, Kilowatt 2, Queen, Bravo, Victor, Strug, Zulu, Lima, in the North Island of New Zealand. See you again.
Okay. I think these cell phones are going to catch on. Only 90% of the countries can you talk to with your cell phone. And you ask the average person who invented a cell phone. Not the only inventor, but one of the major inventors, roughly 1968-1970, is Dr. Reed Fisher of Bell Laboratories at that time. And was he Homedale? No, I think he was in the other New Jersey Bell Laboratories. Anyhow, cell phones were a major invention of cell phones. It was by a ham radio operator named Dr. Reed Fisher. All of a sudden, I've forgotten his call letters. It'll come to me a little bit later. Let's see now. Anybody with any further questions for Paul, WS2N, our space person? Any further space questions before we leave that particular subject? Give me your call letters right now. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yes, I have a question. How do these satellites get fueled in space that are put up there that are, you know, many, many miles up?
Okay, who am I talking to? I haven't heard any name or call letters, which I'd like to have. Go ahead, back to you, sir.
Okay, sorry about that. I had to just readjust my audio. Call us WHYY, so the name is Joe, over here in Sayville.
Yeah, sorry I didn't recognize you, Joe. Your voice is a little bit different on that particular rig you're listening to. I believe you signed in earlier. We tried going back to you on a few times to try to come back to us on the first hour, the question and answer section, so to speak. Now, I know you've asked a question about satellites. You made it sound like how do they get there. You're going to have to give us, in your mind, you have a picture of what that question is you just asked. You haven't given us enough words, Joe, to me to know what is the real question that you're asking. And if I started giving an answer, you'd be unhappy with me because it would be on some other subject. So reword your question, try to give us a little more completeness as to what you're really asking. And by the way, I was wishing you had a chance to try the metal tag technique I was talking about last week. In other words, if you took a small 1-inch or 1.5-inch square of copper tape and put it near, not at, near the tip of your monopole antenna, your whip antenna, it would definitely pull it down in frequency. I was trying to talk you into doing that experiment, and I could tell by what you were saying last week, you didn't have the faith to think that it would work. And you talked about adding length and hitting trees. That's not what I'm asking. I wasn't asking you to adding any extra length to the whip. I was asking you to do an experiment to get your whip to operate at a lower frequency. So B2LYY for those two questions. K2LIW in the TechNet.
My question was for Paul, WS2N, and it goes like this. You put these satellites up at the...